Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show, friends. This week, I do appreciate it. As always, got a really good show coming up for you here today, as we do once a quarter. We're talking beer.
Beer.
That's right. Beer. This time we're chatting about lager. It's kind of our main topic. And when we talk about beers, we're always joined by our regular beer guys and beer experts, Matt Horney, the brewmaster at Old Rail Brewing Company up in Old Mandeville, and Sal Mortilaro, a very well-credentialed and experienced beer judge. In fact, the highest-ranked beer judge or certified beer judge in the state of Louisiana, and one of 65 or so master, grandmaster beer judges. Got to get that straight. So there you go. We're talking about lagers, as I said, and we're also, they stick around for another shot with NOLA Drinks, our podcast only segment. And we're going to have a little fun during that one. Going to flip some anecdotes kind of based on trends in the beer industry and get their reaction to a handful of those kind of off the cuff. Didn't really tell them what I was going to ask them. We talked about a little bit, a couple of them, but for the most part, kind of on the fly there, and we just get Sal and Matt's thoughts and reactions to those ideas. Got a really good show coming up for you next week as well, friends. We're going to continue on with our NOLA Neighborhood series. This will be our second episode thereof. First one aired back in July, and we focused on the Bayou Road area. This time around, we're going to be focusing on the Arethal-Casahaley area there in Central City of New Orleans. And if you're not familiar with the series, friends, the NOLA Neighborhood series, what we do for the most part is we highlight different neighborhoods around the city that you may not be familiar with, whether you're a local or whether you're somebody outside the area. And we want to highlight the economic and cultural importance of these different areas around town with which you may not be familiar. So, for example, we probably won't do one anytime soon in the French Quarter because everybody knows the French Quarter, right? So we want to talk about some of these different places around town that are so important to us here in New Orleans on various levels. So if you live here and you don't know, you will learn, hopefully, about a neighborhood maybe you don't know a heck of a lot about and maybe be motivated to go pay it a visit. But same thing kind of goes if you're from outside the area. We know a lot of you probably out there listening. You love New Orleans. That's probably why you listen to the show. And yeah, you come here. Maybe you come here once a year. Maybe you come here more than that. Or maybe you're still, maybe you're just planning a trip to come down here for the first time. But the idea here is to also highlight, again, for folks like you, highlight neighborhoods that you maybe aren't even thinking of on your itinerary. And we tell you why they're important and why you might want to go visit and some things you can find there. And again, some of the underlying ideas behind their economic and cultural importance that we want to highlight as well. So the Arethal-Casahaley neighborhood is really, really interesting. We're joined by Brent Rosen, who is the president of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and their museum, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, is located right there on that street. We are also joined by Hugo Montero, who is the proprietor owner of Casa Bodega, which is a very fine Mexican restaurant that opened up there about 20 years ago or so, if I have that right, and very much involved in the neighborhood. Of course, and our good friend Pepper Bowen, friend of the show. And Pepper is the director of the Culinaria Center, which is also located, well, it's part of the National Food and Beverage Foundation. And she has a great historical perspective on the importance of the Arethal-Casahaley Boulevard. So we're going to have that coming up for you too, friends. Hey, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to bounce over to Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville to talk about beer and talk about lager and other things with Matt and Sal.
Woohoo!
Come on back.
Bringing them down, and at the break of day, you can hear old Hannah say, give me a pigfoot and a bottle of beer. Send me a gate, I don't care. I feel just like I want a cloud. Give the piano player drink because he's bringing me down. He's got rhythm, yeah. When he stomps his feet, he sends me right off to sleep. Check all your razors and your guns. We're gonna be arrested when the wagon comes. Give me a pig foot and a bottle of beer.
One Scotch, one bourbon, one beer. One Scotch, one bourbon, one beer. Please, Mr. Bartender, listen here. I don't want no trouble, so have no fear. One Scotch, one bourbon, one beer. One Scotch, one bourbon, one beer.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. As always, I do appreciate it. Hey, yeah, we're talking beer, as we do every so often here on the show. And as always, as you know, I'm pleased to welcome back my good friends, Sal Mortellaro and Matt Horney. Gentlemen, good to see you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's good to be back, as always.
As always, we do this about once a quarter, friends. And we sit here and drink beer and talk about it. It's a tough job. And as we noted, you know, at the top of the show that, you know, we've been talking about a lot of serious stuff here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends, lately. And not that these aren't important topics, and we will continue to address those as we do. And not that beer is not an important and serious topic, but sometimes it's just kind of cool to sit around with a couple friends who know a lot about something, drink beers, and talk about it. And that's what we're going to do here today, guys.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Looking forward to it.
There you go. So, hey, what we were going to talk about, we were kind of kicking around different things, as you know, the pre-production here of the NOLA Drink Show pretty much involves, like we did here, we drank a pint or two already and then said, what are we going to talk about today? And what we were drinking, guys, is we were drinking this great lager, Matt, that you've made here at Old Rail Brewing Company in Mandeville. And I said, hey, going back over the couple of years that you guys have been on the show, we've not really ever talked about lagers.
Yeah, we really haven't.
Yeah.
We probably mentioned them a little bit, but we haven't really covered them.
Yeah, just kind of in passing and stuff. So why don't we do this? Let's start here. Let's tell people, just kind of start from the brass tacks, what is a lager?
Well, you have lager and ale yeast. Ale yeast is top fermenting, lager is bottom fermenting. Lagers ferment at a little cooler temperature than ales. They require a little bit more time, and that's kind of the main reason you don't see them so much, is because they take up tank space, and so you can't turn the beers over as quickly.
So kind of explain what you mean by that, Matt. So when you say top fermenting, right?
Yeah.
And so that, like, the opposite would be ales, which is bottom fermenting. Is that correct?
The ales create a krausen on top. You'll get a big foam, a lot of activity going on. Lagers are pretty calm and quiet. They don't really, you know, they'll go through the whole production of CO2 and all that kind of thing as alcohol is produced, but there's not a lot of excitement going on in the tank. You won't have a huge krausen line on the inside of your tank. You're not going to get, you know, a lot of evidence of any activity.
Okay.
But you'll just get some yeast at the end, at the bottom of the tank, and you'll get, you know, a fermented beer. And that's pretty much it. It's a slower process. It's a longer process. It's a quieter process. And it's a colder process.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Do you want to add any thoughts there, Sal, on how we identify what a lager is versus ales versus other styles of beer?
So generally, Matt pretty much touched on one of the main points, is that the different strain of yeast ferments at a much lower temperature, approximately 62 or below, depending on the strain of yeast, anywhere from 58 to 62 degrees is probably the average fermentation temperature.
Now, let me ask you this question. So is that because the type of yeast used in lagers, that's the temperature at which it needs to perform?
Correct, yes. Okay. So there's different strains of yeast, Saccharomyces. It's Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Saccharomyces pastorum. And the lager yeast is going to perform, as Matt noted, at a much lower temperature. It's not going to be as vigorous of a fermentation. Also, too, it's going to put out a cleaner profile. Your ale yeast are going to have a lot of ester production, a lot of fruit flavors. A lager yeast is going to be a very clean, very crisp flavor profile as a whole.
So that's what we're looking for, Matt, right? I mean, kind of synonymous with the lager style is a clean, crisp, dry, right beer.
Yeah, and it depends on the style you're doing. The Helles that we have here at the brewery, usually on tap right now, it's not. It's replaced with a different lager. But it's usually...
Good, good. Sorry, we're mitigating a little bit of noise here real quick. So it's the Helles you're talking about? And
yeah. The Helles... Helles is a little bit fuller in body. It's got a little sweeter, grainy note to it. It can be a little bit more, not, I don't want to call it really biscuity, but a more bready character. And then when you get into the American lager, like you know we've had earlier and I'm having right now, it's a lot cleaner profile. Mm-hmm. The hop note is subdued. The bitterness is kind of subdued. And you just kind of get, we use a rice product in this. So you're getting a little cleaner note, a little simpler, more restrained.
Okay.
You
know?
And when you get into some of those German lagers, you're getting more grain flavor. You're getting more of the German noble hop character and things of that nature. And then you get into the Czech Pilsner, and then it's a whole different game after that.
Okay, so is Pilsner is a type of lager? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. So kind of piggybacking off of what Matt said, I'd like to add that I think lagers as a whole, and this is a very general statement, lagers as a whole are a lot more refined as a beer. They mm-hmm. are not as muddled in flavors. Your yeast esters, your yeast phenolics start to interact with malt and hops, and everything interacts. With lagers, they're generally very crisp, very clean, very refined. You can definitely tell that the problem with lagers is because they are so crisp and clean is that a lot of people argue that lagers are a lot harder to make because you don't hide behind a lot of flavors.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to produce. You can judge a good brewer by how good his lager is because there's you can't hide those flaws, off mm-hmm. aromas, off flavors behind a lot.
Mm-hmm. And on a small production level, then, if we're talking craft brew stuff, and I think we'll get into that maybe in the next segment, but does that present difficulties? I mean, in a certain sense, I guess what I'm asking, Matt, is, you know, a common lager that people maybe don't realize is a lager. We're talking about mm-hmm. things like Budweiser. We're talking about Coors, right? Those are mm-hmm. lagers, so they're doing things on a mass production mm-hmm. scale. Does that kind of correct for error more, or they have the equipment? How does that work where those are just so consistent then?
Yeah, on their scale, if you go into a Budweiser brewery, per se, you're going to probably see very few people. Everything's really automated. It's more streamlined. The reproduction cycle to be able to produce the same quality over and over and over and over again is a lot more refined than what we have here. Everything's manual. And since we're doing batches where we go 10-barrel batch into a 10-barrel tank, we don't have multiple batches backing us up to try and make any adjustments. So what we get on the first go-around is what we get in the end. And so there's really no room for error, you know.
And when you're doing more, there is correction for error. Then,
yeah, if you have a, you know, there's a lot of things in the brewing process. Most people probably don't realize, but when you get a new batch of grain, that batch of grain that was farmed on a different plot of land or had different weather or came from, you know, a different harvest cycle, can yield different results to the brewer. And so on some scales, if we mix grain from one batch to the next, we might get a mixed kind of reading on our gravity. We might be more efficient or less efficient, or if we just, you know, 2 months down the road, we just get a whole new batch of grain, we might be over efficient. Things like that can happen. If you're brewing back to batch, you know, brews, and it's all going into a massive vessel, if one batch is slightly different, you can make an adjustment on the next batch.
Right.
That's true for ales and lagers. But when you're brewing a lager, you kind of want it to be on point every single time,
mm-hmm.
Just to prevent any kind of, you know, nuance from poking its head and being recognized from the drinker who prefers that style of beer every single time.
And as Al said, right, that mm-hmm. that it's harder to hide behind, or it's harder, hide the
yeah.
mistakes
mm-hmm.
and these
yeah.
sort of things. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense, too, I guess, from what you're saying, too, where people become attached to a particular style or a particular brand or, mm-hmm. or beer maker such as yourself. That consistency kind of matters mm-hmm. too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you know, going on what Sal was saying, you know, there's a lot of beers out there with a lot of flavor, you know, an Imperial Stout, New England IPA, all these kind of things, fruited sours, like we have here as well. There's a lot of beautiful beers out there, but when it all comes down to the lager, it's really simple. And some people will say, "Well, this is too simple for my mm-hmm. taste." But in mm-hmm. all actuality, there's beauty in simplicity. And so it's kind of neat to see a beer that can be so simple, but yet have so many nuances of flavor that cover a broad spectrum. It's kind of fun to enjoy that as well.
That's a really good point. So you're talking about dealing with sort of a limited playing field, but mm-hmm. finding that diversity on mm-hmm. that limited
right.
playing field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Sal, do me a favor. Tell people a little bit about where do we find lagers in the world? I know that's kind of a broad question, but and it's a big is that the most commonly
made beer? So in your traditional styles, your traditional mm-hmm. brewing countries, by far the largest country that produces lagers is obviously going to be Germany. Mm-hmm. You're going to have your Bock, your Doppelbock, your Pilsners, your Helles's, your Oktoberfests. That's going to be probably the country as a whole that puts out the most lagers. And probably I'd even say that Germany has more traditional German styles as more lagers than anything, vast majority lagers than
okay,
anything.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Do you think are lagers the most commonly made beer on the planet then? Would we say that? Would that be a fair
probably
guess?
Probably on a mass scale, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I would say
by sales volume, I would probably say that's
lagers. What, yeah, like production, because mm-hmm. I'm thinking like most Mexican mm-hmm.
Corona,
Central American beer, mm-hmm. South American beers, the ones that you kind of see. Those are all lagers, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the most part. I mean,
Budweiser puts out hectoliters, mm-hmm. Just ridiculous amounts of beer, yep.
Mm. Right. Got it. So Germany, so we've already noted kind of like Budweiser, Coors, those guys, and I just mentioned like a lot of the Central mm-hmm. and South American beers, mm-hmm. Czech Republic.
Sure.
Now, when we say if we switch to something like the UK, then are we finding lagers in the UK, or are they very, very ale-driven? Almost,
they're very ale-driven.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of a there isn't an English lager that I'm aware of.
Okay.
You start getting into maybe the no, yeah, no.
No.
Yeah,
okay.
They're
some
all
of that,
ale-driven.
Some of that
yeah.
plays back into the water chemistry, and we talked
sure.
about that several times, and the water chemistry in England is drastically different than the water chemistry in Munich, and so they brewed the beer that suited – you know, whatever that water would do with the grain is kind of how it played out.
Okay.
So you find more bitter, hoppier kind of stuff in England. You find less bitter, somewhat dark, but less hoppier beers in Germany.
Now, is it an alkaline thing in the water, or is it just a whole mess of different mineral consideration?
It's more of the mineral consideration. When you go to like England, the Burton-on-Trent water, mm-hmm. which is a popular, most well-known thing about English beers, ESBs and things like that, they had a high sulfate content, which played well with the hops. It accentuated the hop bitterness, makes the beer a little drier, and that worked well for that kind of style. But then when you get to Germany, their water profile is a lot different. For darker beers, which is what they were really well known for, you know, Dunkels and the Bock and stuff like that, you could work with the acidity and the malt to bring down the pH and things. When the popularity of the lighter beers came onto the scene and Germany wanted to kind of compete with some of the other beers that were kind of being produced with the Pilsners and stuff, they produced some of the lighter beers, and they may have had to make some adjustments there to their water. And some of those things, I mean, Germany has some pretty strict rules. You're not allowed to really
right.
mess with much.
Right.
And that comes down to the water, too. So, you know, processes of boiling the water to reduce some of the or you know, precipitate some of the minerals out is kind of a trick they would implement.
Okay, cool. Well, let's do this, you guys, before we bounce into another topic or question here talking about the world of lagers. Let's take a little break here on the mm-hmm. show. We're going to come back and we're going to talk some ideas with some trends that we're seeing in the lager world and some other considerations as it relates to this style of beer. So we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. Come on.
It's got a hole in it. That bucket's got a hole in it. That bucket's got a hole in it. And we can't buy no more beer. Yes, a hole in it. Yeah, man, the bucket's got a hole in it. That bucket's got a hole in it. Come on in there, Frankie, lay one on them, daddy.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Friends, we're at Old Rail Brewing Company here in Old Mandeville, Louisiana. That's right, and we're talking about beers with Matt and Sal, as we do. And I'll bring this up because it would not be a show with you guys without this, that you are the unpaid beer correspondents here on the NOLA Drink Show, and I
always
do. I do appreciate that.
We're here for the free beer.
You and I are here for the free beer. I mean, I was actually
right.
Mac.
So
is,
am I.
Yeah. Mac gets like the raw end of the deal here, Sal, because it's like you and I show up and get free beer and we talk about it. And he's the one that's like, he's even getting up and getting us beers.
Mm-hmm. Hey, if I get to drink beer, there's no raw end in that, right?
Okay, fair enough. I like your can-do and team attitude there, Matt. That's good stuff. But friends, we're talking about lagers right now. And let me ask you guys this question, because we're talking about sort of where you find lagers and how they're made and the concepts of them being sort of very clean and very fresh, typically dry. I find it really interesting because when we're talking about, say, Sal, as you said, with ales and certain beers, you know, maybe you can kind of hide faults and hide behind certain things. But when we look at, I think, a lot of the older beers, when we look at the older German beers, I'm thinking you were talking about Czech Pilsner, like Pilsner Urquell, mm-hmm. which is, I know it's a big production beer now, but has been around for a long time. A lot of mm-hmm. those beers are actually lagers, right?
Correct. Yep. So a lot of those beers, it's interesting because most of your minus, and we can talk about that later, minus some of your strange lagers, because mm-hmm. you do have some lagers here and there, but most of your lagers, traditional lagers, are going to be German. And you almost kind of wonder if, you know, during the cold German months, they would produce these beers and just kind of store them in the snow or in a cold cave, and that's where they were produced, so they could sit for several months until it was time to drink during the spring or fall or whatever the case may be. But yeah, a lot of these are going to be very old, very traditional styles.
Now, so. one of the things that we've talked about, guys, on the show before, and I think it's relevant here, I'm going to guess, is, you know, we're kind of thinking of like the Budweisers of the world or how Pilsner Urquell is made today, whatever it may be, very clean, very consistent. We're not talking about wild yeast fermentation and some things like that we've touched on before. So, I'm guessing that probably to some degree, going back 200, 300, 400 years, or, you know, in some cases, you know, 1,000 years, that these beers were probably a bit, even lagers are probably a bit more inconsistent. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. I would say so. when you take into consideration, you know, the use of stainless steel hasn't been around that long in the brewing process. If you're trying to brew a lager and something really fine and clean and going through the filtration process and making it all bright and crispy, I would love to go back, you know, 200 years or whatever and try a lager from, you know, Germany back then and see what it tasted like. Mm-hmm. A lot of those breweries that have producing these beers that are still around today have been around for a long time. And, it would be kind of neat to go back and try their original stuff and see what it was like.
Right. Because mm-hmm. the reason I was even asking that question in my tiny brain here is that, you know, you would think like going back in time, you would produce a beer that was, you know, mm-hmm. could be have a lot more faults and be masked. Mm-hmm. But I mean, lagers probably were maybe that way.
Yeah, and well, that kind of brings up an interesting kind of thing, because you look at Schlenkerla, which is in Germany, and that was one of the, I think, the two remaining ones in the world, which is a smoked beer brewery.
Oh, yeah, we had those mm-hmm. not too long yeah. ago with you guys. Yeah,
and all that's lagers as well. And it was brewed over, you know, basically fire-brewed equipment, and that's where you got that smoked flavor from, was with the wood that was used to heat the boil kettle and the mash tun and all that kind of stuff. Those, that wood added a certain, you know, characteristic to that beer that is still replicated today in the same way that they would have tried to do it back then. But that was kind of, you know, by today's terms would be considered a fault in the beer, because you don't want that, but it created its own style. And so mm-hmm. now it's been kind of separated and, you know, categorized and preserved, and it kind of is a little throwback to what it used to be like. So more breweries back then would have been like that, you know.
That's a really good point. Mm-hmm. That's a really, really good point. Sal, let me ask you this question, because you're talking about, you know, sort of theorizing on being able to put the beers away for a while, store them in a cold cave consideration. The cold process, being colder through fermentation and even storage, is that like a stabilizing element that can help with consistency perhaps?
Well, there is. So the term lager means to lay down or to let age, right? And one of the main things, and Matt touched on the earlier segment about how it takes up tank space, and to delve into that a little bit more deeply, what he meant was that when you make a lager, even today, with these clean yeast and stainless steel and all of these sanitization that they may not have known about back then, you still have to give that lagering time or time to age to allow things to kind of clear up and come together. So, yeah, by all means, I really do believe that by letting it sit for several months, even today, by letting it sit for several months, you get a much more clean, taste-wise, aroma-wise, and clear appearance-wise of a product.
Okay, that makes sense. Because and so maybe not necessarily a straight... I'm coming from an angle, as you guys know, that I have more familiarity with wine. So cold-stabilizing wine is a way to actually... you know, create a stable product and not have issues of re-fermentation and other things like that. So that's why I was kind of curious if maybe that was a way that the beer was sort of preserved. But so it's laying it down to basically have it come together.
Sure.
In flavor.
Okay. Yeah. It kind of falls along with the ales. It's like you want to barrel age something, you want to let it sit, let those malts kind of like the chocolatey, raisiny, caramelly kind of things kind of like, kind of surface and level out a little bit.
Okay,
and
maybe
certain
lay
things
back
come forward.
And, okay,
yeah, and lay back. Alcohol smooths out over time. Mm-hmm. But with the lagers, it's kind of doing that, but on a different kind of scale. It's not as I don't know. It's not as bold in some regards.
Okay, just because of the style of beer that we're talking about, and the flavor profile is already kind of narrower to begin with.
Yeah, and some of the ales you want to do that too. But a lot of stuff like the IPAs, the American IPAs especially, New England IPAs, depending on how you do your New England IPA, you can let that sit a little bit longer and you want it to kind of fall out because they're hazy and you don't want it to like, you know, be all gritty and burn your throat kind of thing with like a bunch of hot bitterness. That's not supposed to be there. But the West Coast IPAs, you want to get those out as fast as possible. So it's kind of counterintuitive to, you know, lager brewing where you want to let it sit.
Got it. Mm-hmm. When we talk about alcohol levels, guys, in lagers, is there a consideration there? Kind of like, is there a range? I think like a lot of people, if we're hearkening to the Budweisers of the world, you know, we're talking about like 3.5% or whatever those beers typically are, right around that kind of range. Is there a point where we sort of top out where it's just not even really a lager anymore?
Knows a little bit about that.
That's where I was got to go. I think I see that smile.
So there's a talking about strange lagers. There's a couple of really weird. A lot of people think lagers. They think these clear beer that are very, you know, simple in
lower
flavors,
ABV.
You know, anywhere from light straw to medium gold color. There's a particular style of beer called the Sammy Klaus that's brewed out of Austria, and it's brewed once a year. And it's brewed on St. Nicholas Day, which I believe is December 23rd, I believe. In this one particular brewery, the Schlossberg Brewery does it once a year, and their version gets up to about 14%. It's a very particular yeast that's been through genetics in breeding, for lack of better terms, has gotten a very high, high-tolerant beer. I did a Sammy Klaus version that actually took a gold medal at the Belgian Big Beer and Barley Wine Festival a few years ago in Vail, Colorado. And I topped out right at about 18% alcohol on it.
Wow.
For a beer. Very, very big. Very nice sipping beer, warms you up on the inside.
And you can tell it was 18%.
But really? Yeah, yeah, sure, yeah. And yeah, it's extremely smooth, extremely drinkable, but it'll sneak up on you.
Right.
So those are the anomalies. But again, through genetic breeding, I guess, you can kind of filter out those really
high-performing, high-alcohol yeast will still stand up to the amount of alcohol, but then still give you a lager characteristic.
Correct.
Through fermentation. That's really interesting. Let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break here on the show, and then we're going to come back. We're chatting a little bit more about lagers. I think we're going to touch on some craft lager considerations and some other things moving forward. As always, Matt and Sal will stick around for another shot with NOLA Drinks. We'll maybe continue with lagers, or we might have a few anecdotes and some reactions to those anecdotes to share with y'all, friends. Come on back.
Thank you. gonorrhea. Let's have a party, drink a lot of beer.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening, and friends, this week, as always, we're talking about beer with Matt and Sal, as we always do throughout the year here. And we're talking about lagers, guys, and we were talking during the break, Matt, you were mentioning, you know, the sort of idea that, you know, we've been awash, especially sort of, you know, our beer nerdness here and, mm-hmm. and craft beer market and things like that, sort of awash in ales and, you know, barley wines mm-hmm. and all these things. And we were talking about, you know, China. We were talking about Latin America. I mentioned some of this on the air, but during the break, there's a big world of lagers out mm-hmm. there that people have been doing a fine job making good beers mm-hmm. for a long time
right.
in that style.
Well, it's there's a lot of macro breweries out there that, you know, the producers of Qingdao and the Snow Lake we were
in
talking.
China, yeah.
That are big, Budweiser, Miller Coors, all these other Labatt, all that big stuff. And it just, it's everywhere. It's advertised. It kind of, it's all over the place. So when you think of lager, you just think of those lagers. And in those markets, that's what those people culturally drink. In China, it's just lager. That's all there is. They haven't been exposed to the New England IPAs, and maybe there might be somebody over there brewing them. I don't know. But, you know, we've been spoiled by, you know, the barrel age souse and the barrel age barley wines and the New England IPAs and the West Coast IPAs and, you know, pale ales and all this wonderful
so
stuff.
Experimentation and broader uh-huh. base of styles. And,
yeah.
Okay.
And while we're all caught up in all of this and, you know, us brewers, we always have these conversations on whether or not the lager is going to make its comeback. And people say, oh, it's, they said that last year. They said it the year before. They said this and this and that. And, you know, in the reality of it, it's, we're so curious in this beer culture in the United States that we have now, but we've never, you know, to be so close-minded that you can't explore it or you're going to put the style down and you're saying, I'm not going to go there. When, if you open that door, there's way more than just light lager. There's way more than, you know, just this clear filtered beer, which we do here. And we love it because it's a challenge. It's difficult.
And it's a good one.
Uh-huh. And it meets a demand in our market. But outside of that, you have the Maibock, you have the Doppelbock, you have the Dunkel, you have these wheat beers and things like that. There's all sorts of stuff when you kind of really just go down that rabbit hole that lagers are more than just these corporate kind of clear, low ABV beers. And like we were talking with the Sammy Klaus, it's like you can even go that route if you want. Mm-hmm. So where's the barrel aged Doppelbock or Strongbock or where, you know, there's so many things you can do. And we have so much more beer culture to create in this country, you know, why not lager? So you see it in Denver. There's quite a few lager breweries in Denver and very, very good ones. You know, there's plenty of room to create a new cycle and a new turn in this country.
Do we think that's coming, Sal? I mean, we were kind of joking, like everybody says lager is going to be the next big thing, and it's still on the craft scene, of course, we're talking about. What do you think, man?
Well, you know, Matt mentioned Denver, and there is a particular brewery out there, Bierstadt, mm-hmm. where all of the GABF judges, you know, kind of the best of the best throughout
Great
the
American
world,
Beer
Great
Festival.
American Beer Fest judges. It's kind of a bit of an unspoken rule that everybody stops over there to have their lagers before you know, when you get in town or after you're judging, you go over there and go have a lager.
So go have like a lager and then go judge your New England IPAs?
Pretty much,
Or
yeah.
after you've
yeah.
had a million New England IPAs, go clear the palate with a lager?
Exactly. Okay. Or you want a good, proper, you know, a good, proper, well-made beer that really just kind of acknowledges the art form, the hands-on, clean, quality expertise and quality of getting that nice flavor out there. So mm-hmm. They do a lovely Pilsner out there, you know, they're great beers. They really are great beers. They're hard to produce, and you can sit back and enjoy that complexity that's in a simple beer.
I think that's really well put, that it's complexity in a simple beer, and it, you know, things don't have to be overly complex mm-hmm. to actually be very good.
Right. That's true. And I think when you look at it on a craft scale, like here we have the Trace in Mandeville, you know, and there's a lot of places around the country that have things like this in Portland and Denver and you know, other places that have activities outside of breweries where you can finish your activity and go on your bike ride or go on your run. And when you get back to the brewery, sometimes like a really hazy, heavy New England IPA isn't going to be what you want. And you might just want something clean and crisp. And that's where the lager comes in. And it's, you know, it's even a blonde ale doesn't, for me, doesn't, it's not going to cut it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, lagers have their place and they are refreshing. And, you know, I hope to see more of them.
And so we were kind of talking about the general trend. Mm-hmm. It does seem like we are seeing more people take on the challenge on the craft mm-hmm. brew level of yeah. making mm-hmm. lagers, right?
Mm-hmm. The scary thing is, and we were talking about this earlier, is like you don't – with lagers in the craft beer scene around the country, when I travel around and you taste something, you don't want to just dump some Cascade on it. You don't want to just
throw
some special hop on it okay. or, you know, some – the latest, you don't want to put Galaxy in there, you know. And a lot of people say, oh, it's been Americanized. You know, you don't want to do that. It's like kind of stay true to tradition. You can experiment a little bit. I think that's great. But don't overstep it with a lager because they are so simple and they are so delicate. It's like, I don't know, it's the butterfly of beer. You don't want to touch it or you're going to ruin it. It won't mm-hmm. be able to fly again. So it's like you just got to be mindful when you're making them. But as close to traditional is always the best, I would say.
Yeah. Sure. And do you think, I mean, it's maybe even fair to say in this instance, and you guys have heard me say this before, one of the things that make me the most nervous is when I go out to a bar and I read in their cocktail list where they say, this is our riff on a Sazerac.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, can you actually make a Sazerac? Because I don't sure. care what your riff is on it until right. you can actually make it. Got point, you know, cliche mm-hmm. is got to know the rules to break them.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm all about exploration, but all beers come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain standards. And as a BJCP guy, there
Beer Judging Certification Program.
That's the one.
You're all about acronyms, man. I got to, just so people know what we're talking about.
You know, being with the BJCP, they are very style heavy. You know, certain things define a German Pilsner. Certain things define an Oktoberfest. But with that being said, I mean, I am all about pushing those style guidelines. I'm all about mm-hmm. exploring and creating mm-hmm. new things. In fact, some of what we consider classic styles today are because people pushed that envelope way back when.
Right, sure.
You know, porters, stouts, what caused light beers. Mm-hmm. And without getting to the whole history of Gabriel Sedemeyer and all of those guys. But, you know, you're right. I mean, okay, cool. You want to play with stouts and you want to make this wacky pastry stout, but can you brew a stout?
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I agree with that 100%.
Yeah. And it's kind of one of those things where we've had a conversation in the brewer circle, beer scene around here, where somebody had a take on the fact that, well, you know, that's been done. Why do we keep doing it? Let's move on to other stuff. Let's develop new things. Let's keep playing and evolving. And I'm like, that's great. But here in New Orleans, we wouldn't do that with our music.
Sure.
We mm-hmm. preserve it and we appreciate it and we continue its legacy. And that's what we kind of do with some of these older beer styles. Like, you can experiment with them. You can do whatever you want with them. But we keep brewing them because of their legacy.
And if it works, it mm-hmm. works, right?
Right?
If it ain't,
I mean, they've been around a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this, you guys. We've got to close out the portion of the radio show here, and then you guys are going to stick around for another mm-hmm. shot with Noel Drinks. But Matt, we got about 45 seconds left, a minute. Mm-hmm. Tell people where they can find you here at Old Rail.
Yeah,
Brewery.
We're in Old Mandeville. We're on 639 Gerard Street. We're just east of the causeway. North of New Orleans.
About 40 minutes north of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. And yeah. Sal, we certified beer judge, master beer judge, which I think, you know, we gave you props for last time because you just passed your test. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But tell people BJCP, Beer Judging Certification Program.
Beer Judge Certification Program. Find them on Facebook. Find them at bjcp.org. Kind of the gold standard of beer judging, both commercial and homebrew. And that's it. And if I want to make one more shout out, we
sure.
talked about Larry Fest last time.
Yep.
If anybody listening came, thank you so much. We ended up raising $26,000 for the Humane Society here. I want to personally thank you if you showed up and
awesome.
Supported us. So
cool.
Thanks again.
Awesome. Well, guys, we're going to close out this portion of the radio show. As I mentioned, you guys are going to stick around for another shot with Noel Drinks. Friends, if you're listening on the radio, be sure to go to our website, noladrinks.com, because you're going to want to get the podcast on any of your favorite podcast networks. We're on most of them. And we're going to talk a little bit more about beer. And I've got a little bit of a fun little thing we're going to do here with Matt and Sal. So, friends, if you are listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all.
Everybody! stop and jive, stop acting dead, cause we're alive. And drink Jack beer.
Drink Jack beer.
Good Jack beer.
Good Jack beer.
Hello, mellow Jack. Best beer in town. Man, don't be like Ed the Boys Reader. Grab a Jack and be a leader. And drink Jack beer.
Drink Jack beer.
Mellow Jack beer.
Mellow Jack beer.
Hello, mellow Jack. Best beer in town.
And he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try to bend your ear. It don't matter who you're serving, we're all the same down here.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Hope you are enjoying our chat about lagers with Matt and Sal. These guys are always just impressive with their beer knowledge. A lot of fun to talk with them. I always learn a ton. And yeah, we're going to bounce right back over to Older Ale in just a second to talk with those guys this time around. We're not really going to talk about lagers anymore. We're going to get their reactions to some trends in the contemporary beer world, friends. And after that, I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. All right, everybody, have another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. We're talking beers here at Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville, a stone's throw away from New Orleans. So, friends, if you're in New Orleans, hop on the Causeway, drive over right off the Causeway, come check out Maddie's great, great beer maker, great program. And if you're coming to visit New Orleans, and especially if you're like saying, hey, I want to get out of the city a little bit, this is also a great place to come and check it out. Good food, good beers. And you'll find Matt here back toiling away making quality lagers like the Oktoberfest that we just tasted. Good stuff, Matt, on the Oktoberfest, buddy. Thanks for sharing that out of the tank, man.
I'm definitely excited to get that thing on tap.
Yeah, me too.
Glad to share it.
Yeah, that's cool. And always appreciate the sneak preview there, don't we, Sal?
Yes, sir.
I just asked you that because I was making sure you were paying attention.
Yes. Yeah, I'm happy to drink beer out of the tank always.
So what I want to do with you guys here in our Another Shot with Nola Drink segment, sometimes we get a little more serious, a little more technical, but I think we covered our lager ground pretty well. So kind of switching it up a little bit, and we were kind of talking about some sort of trends and anecdotal trends in the brew world, and I just kind of wanted to get your reaction. I actually pulled an article to give full credit off of Vine Pair and just some about 20 quotes from different people in the beer industry talking about their least favorite trends so far in 2019. And one of them, let's start there. Lactose and IPA is not a fan. How do we feel?
We're guilty of making it, that's for sure.
Okay. Wait, tell me what it means.
So milk sugar lends a kind of creaminess to beer. It's in our Cowcatcher Milk Stout, which is what it's most known. That's what you would use lactose typically for is milk stout. It evolved into going into New England IPA. It's hazy. It's fruity.
Is that a mouthfeel thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. It gives it like a creamy texture. So they came out with these like milkshake IPAs. And you put in the lactose, you add vanilla, and you might put in some fruit, and you got the hoppy tropical character. And there's some really good ones out there. I mean, they're not bad beer. I mean, it's like Sal was saying, it's evolution of style. You know, play around with it, create something. You might hit, you know, it might be a trend, but, you know, trends don't always last, but the beer can.
Yeah.
I had Gnarly Barley's the other day, and it was nice.
Local brewery here. Yeah.
And it was enjoyable. I think it's some people just don't like them, but it's like any other beer. I'm like, if it tastes good and it's brewed well,
then it tastes good. Yeah. Okay. There you go. And mm-hmm. Sal, do you think, I mean, your reaction, and do you think maybe it's kind of one of those sort of snotty things where sort of like certain beer nerds and things are, I just don't think it's cool and I'm over it.
You know, one of the best home brews, I was up judging the Natural State Pro-Am competition in Arkansas a few weeks ago. One of the best home brews I ever had was actually Milkshake IPA. And it tasted like an Orange Julius. For all you New Orleans folks, you know what that is.
Yeah, beyond
New Orleans,
man. It tasted
like an Orange Julius.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting.
It was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that was mm-hmm. that was big in my youth in California, man. Okay, so cool. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So maybe a little bit overstated there. How about this one? The liberal interpretation of double dry hopping, or DDH.
DDH
is an actual process. I'll let you guys describe it, but there's some controversy in the industry, right? Uh-huh. Like exactly what the hell double dry hopping means, and are people sort of overusing it? I'll start with you, Sal, because we started with Matt last time.
What is the definition of is?
Is what it is. That's right.
No, I mean, you know, you see a lot of these Facebook
alternative
groups.
Facts on double dry hopping.
There's a lot of Facebook talk, these groups, beer groups, and, you know, double dry hop means you put it in first and then you add some later, but does that mean it's double the amount of hops? And it's a big old issue of contention.
So is it double the hops, or is it the dry?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
none of the above, or both of the above? Mm-hmm. So what are we, Matt, what are we actually talking about if somebody, like, if we were to maybe be trying to be technically correct, what would double dry hopping mean? Or
this is really interesting because back when I was in my homebrewing days, this is like in the early 2000s, and everybody wanted to like brew like a Pliny clone or, mm-hmm. you know, something like that with a lot of hops in it. You would double dry hop it, which meant two dry hop additions. That's what all the clone recipes would say. Now it became a marketing thing.
Sure.
And it's basically you're doubling the dry. It's two times dry hopped.
Yeah.
So two different times or
double the amount.
Okay.
The amount. And I have always been on the fence with this, and I've had this conversation with brewers, but I always would assume to me that double dry hopped is dry hopping once, mm-hmm. and then you wait, and then you dry hop again. Whether or not you multiply it by a multiplier, that's just the recipe.
Mm-hmm.
But your method of one addition and then a second addition, or whether it's a third or fourth or fifth or sixth or seventh, it doesn't matter. It could be quadruple dry hopped. That just tells you it's dry hopped, you know, eight times. Doesn't mean eight times the hops. I just think
quintuple five, just so we're clear.
Yes. Okay. Quintuple dry.
Yeah, I'm not. Yes.
Octuple? Yeah.
ODH?
Yeah, that seems.
My beer is like ODH.
There you go. That's
quadruple
what we are,
would be four. Yeah, sorry about that. I'm trying to get more for my money.
Well, that would be a double quadruple dry hop. Yes, that would be eight times, right?
Yeah, double quad. Yeah. Yeah. See, then we start.
You see how convoluted it gets?
Yeah, I like that. Let's create a new acronym. This beer is ODH, man. Octuple dry hopped.
But I agree with Matt. That is what a double dry hop is. Two times. Two separate additions.
Yes. Okay, got it. That makes sense. Now, what about this one, you guys? And I'm going to kind of paraphrase because this was another quote that I think is kind of interesting. And we see a lot of nerdiness in the bourbon world, in the wine world, and certainly in the beer world. And again, paraphrasing greatly, but a trend that this person doesn't see going away is all the hype that comes around beers. And this whole idea, if maybe everybody gets excited about a beer, it's a limited production beer, and then you go wait in line for said beer, or you pay an exorbitant amount, or both of said beer, that goes on, and people get very sort of cultish about it and get very excited. And I like this person's point, and we know that people do that, and we're not necessarily commenting on that part, but then the idea of if the beer is not maybe not so good or somewhat disappointing, the difficulty maybe if you spent all that money and waited all that time and want to get into a pissing contest about actually having the sack to say the beer's not that good.
Mm-hmm. this is something I have never done. I have never seeked out beer.
Well, I've heard you say beers aren't good. You've had the sack to do that. You mean like wait in line?
Well, wait in line.
I'm messing with you.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah. I've never waited in line for a beer. I just don't. I mean, it's okay if they want to do it. Let's be honest. I don't want to upset anybody or make any offensive comments to anybody who may have already done it. I think it's totally fine if you do it. It's just something I've never personally done because this goes back to the homebrewer days, and this is why we became homebrewers. If you couldn't afford to buy it, or if you couldn't get it, you made it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to go wait in line for 5 hours or overnight or get a ticket for something if I can just figure out a way to make it. and then I can have all I want, and it's going to cost me maybe, you know, $65, $70 or whatever for 5 gallons, whatever it is. I don't know. But I've never done that for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I was a home brewer. That's how my mind works in this brewing world. And when we brew stuff, we hold on to things. We sell our things. We age them and we release them. But we don't build a hype around it. If you come in and it's on tap, you get it. There's some people that we post on Facebook or whatever like that. But it's just, it's beer.
Yeah. You know? Okay. Good point. Yeah.
Enjoy it. You know,
it's a fleeting thing.
It's a fleeting thing. And if you're disappointed that, you know, you spent some money on it, I mean, you know, maybe go to the homebrew supply store and make one.
Okay. There you go. Let me ask you the same, Sal, because Matt gave us a very diplomatic answer there. And what you and I were talking about this before we started taping the show, this idea just of the sort of the psychology behind a lot of this. And you're, with the BJCP, I know you're very active in some of like the Facebook beer groups and stuff that are out there. And, you know the term I always throw around, being a cocktail hero, but being like a beer hero, right? In this instance, do we see this sort of psychology where maybe, and we're not naming names here, but like a beer that comes out, everybody's hyped about, and then it comes out and maybe it's just not all that good, but people aren't going to, because of the pride thing.
Yeah, sure. You know, people don't want to sell themselves out, be it their time, their effort, their money. You may wait in line and pay some exorbitant price for a bottle of insert whatever, and it's really not that great. But you see it on Untappd a lot. And I have tasted some of these beers, and I have objectively thought, like, what are they talking about? It's really not that great.
Mm-hmm.
You do see that a lot.
So we see some ego in sure. within nerdiness,
absolutely.
Right? And the pride
yeah.
kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Let's do two more. So one of the ones also in here, talking about when people chiming in, and maybe we're even talking about in Facebook groups and these kinds of things, and I'll come to you, Sal, first on this one, this idea that when you're sort of tasting a particular style of beer or, we'll go with that style of beer, that people are kind of locked into this idea of comparing it to the archetype of the beer in the category without maybe taking the category on a broader level. And again, I'm very much paraphrasing this person's quote, but this idea, like, if I'm going to drink this, well, it doesn't taste like this one, so it's not it. It didn't hit the mark. It's not good. And is that a fair thing to kind of say? Because maybe that beer is what it is, but there's a broader, like we're talking about today, lagers. It's a big world.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Oh, no, absolutely. It is a big world. Pilsner for whatever. Yeah, sure. Certain things define a Pilsner, if you will, but you still have some latitude in that. And you may like your Pilsner a little more bitter, a little more malt forward, than compared to this one that you're drinking, but that doesn't necessarily warrant that it's in the world of Untappd, that's a 2.5 bottle cap beer because it doesn't taste what, like, I think it should.
That specific
it doesn't
one.
Taste like, Pilsner or Quell or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and is it fair to say, Matt, I mean, I guess I'll ask this question because I'm reminded of two things. It's sort of like this idea that maybe the way to put it is it's not hard rock if it doesn't sound exactly like Led Zeppelin. Or who was it? I think it was maybe in Austin Powers. If it's not Scottish, it's crap.
Right.
Kind of idea.
Right.
Well, I'm just going to add this in there. We don't know what questions you're going to be asking us, and this is kind of fun.
Yeah, this is actually pretty great. Yeah. This is lovely.
So for what it's worth. But yeah, on this one, we see our Untappd stuff. A lot of brewers don't really look at it anymore. And you'll see stuff on there where, this is this just tastes like this, or this doesn't taste like this. I don't know if I really like it. If there's a brewery out there, and I've always kind of wondered if this happens, if you live in a town in somewhere USA or North America or wherever it is in the world, and your brewery is making a specific style of beer, and you just love this brewery because it's your neighborhood brewery, and you think that's what the style should taste like, and you go someplace else, and it's a world-class example, and you don't like it, does that make you wrong, or does that make you just uneducated? I don't know.
Does that make the whole category not worthwhile, right? Uh-huh.
So that's where I always say, and this is what I still do as a brewer, because you're always learning. I don't know everything about beer, and I travel. I go and I try and get the biggest swath of all the beers I can, and I taste them all, and I just try and understand it, and then I can make my assessment from that. And whether, I really like one beer for a particular thing. That's my personal preference. But does it meet the style guidelines? As a beer judge, I'll look at it with that those eyes. But I can at least I can take one cap off and put the other cap on, and mm-hmm. I can make a good decision on it. And I hope, you know, beer drinkers, as we evolve and we become more into this world of beer globally, that we can kind of like look at it more intellectually and understand what exactly we are drinking, because I think that's important for the success of the people that are doing it right, and pays homage to the history and keeps the styles going that are brewed the way they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So long story short, when you see these kinds of things, I just hope that people start looking things more openly and not
just compare it to a single thing, right? These categories are broad, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of variety within these categories, mm-hmm. and within these styles, yeah. and these things. Mm-hmm. So, and actually, I think it was Groundskeeper Willie from The Simpsons that said, "It's not Scottish, it's crap." I need to correct myself there or something. One of those guys, the fat guy from Austin Powers, or Groundskeeper Willie, one of the two. All right, last one that we're going to do, and we didn't talk about this one even remotely, just sort of in passing at all. Seltzers in breweries.
Oh, yeah.
Is that being lazy? Is that being a placeholder kind of thing? You know, because like this person was poo-pooing seltzers in breweries because they were basically saying, well, you know, it's not beer. And I'll lift from the quote here. I can get down with hazy IPAs, pastry stouts, and even beer cocktails, but seltzer is a quick cop-out for a lot of fledgling places.
Hmm. Wow.
You know, so I was at a...
because I've been... Oh, sorry, so I've been drinking, and I won't name brands, a certain mm-hmm. particular seltzer here because it's hot in Louisiana during the summertime, mm-hmm. like a Tulane sorority girl. So I'm kind of a fan of it right now, just full
it
disclosure.
It was pumpkin spice flavor?
Yeah, right. We're coming into the season, bro. Somebody's going to do it. So a pumpkin spice hard seltzer. I'm totally on board. But I didn't mean to interrupt you. What were you going to say?
No, you know, so piggybacking off it, it's not alcoholic. Went to Houston not long ago for some BJCP stuff. And stopped over there at St. Arnold's, and they actually had hop water. It was not alcoholic, but it was hop-flavored water. Mm. Really awesome, really cool. How do you make a hard seltzer? I don't have a clue. I mean, what do? You take soda water and dump some Everclear in it? I really don't know.
I'm guessing it's – I mean, and I don't really know either. Should probably know. I'm guessing it's just like a clear, great, like, you know, high-proof grape distillate or something like that that's just a neutral spirit.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I I don't know about this one. I think it's kind of like catering to a new market. Mm-hmm. This is like a kind of a new thing. But I don't know how you actually achieve that. Because do you throw a couple kernels of grain in there and one little hot pellet to make it sellable? I'm not really sure how people get it.
I just even think maybe the question is kind of interesting conceptually, mm-hmm. because some people are maybe being purist here, right? Mm-hmm. And they're saying it's not beer, so it shouldn't be sold in a mm-hmm. brewery or a brew pub. Mm-hmm. And then I think other people, the argument that they make is that, well, you know, not everybody loves beer, and it mm-hmm. provides an alternative that can be made, you know, sort of fresh and produced in-house and these sorts of things.
Well, I think if you're looking at it from a tasting room kind of environment, not from a brew pub setting, because we have wine, we have liquor,
sure,
we have beer. If somebody's going to a brewery and it's just beer and somebody else right. is tagging along with you and they don't like beer, I guess, yeah, and you can't sell wine, you can't sell liquor. That's a good alternative. Mm-hmm. I could see that. Mm-hmm.
Does it bother you, though? I mean,
doesn't really bother me. Yeah, I don't think so.
I didn't think you would answer uh-huh. that it would. I think yeah. so. Yeah, okay. Mm.
Let me piggyback one thing. I know we're Please. About to close it out. Piggyback off of Matt's point where we were talking about if you have this world-class example of a beer. You know, one of the things that really drives me up the wall, and I think Matt's going to agree, we've talked about this at length, is if I can't stand these folks that get on Untappd, and you have a...
And tell people
example,
what Untappd is.
So Untappd is an app where it allows you to check in beers, track beers you've drank. You get these various badges you know, going to this brewery or that brewery or trying these styles. You can find it on iPhone and pretty much any platform, Google Store or whatever. It's actually really cool. I use it personally for just seeing all the beers, various beers.
Just kind
I've
of record
tried.
Keeping. Yeah, just record keeping. And, yeah, sure, it makes sense.
So one of the things that really grinds my gears and drives me up the wall is that these
you
guys...
You can swear on this segment, that, Sal, by yeah. the way, if you really want to.
One of the really things that really fucking pisses me off is
that
these
came
guys,
really natural.
So you got these ones that'll check into Untappd, right? And, you know, you might walk into insert whatever brewery there, and it's probably one of the best stouts, for example, that I personally have ever tasted. Instead of stars, they use bottle caps. So they may say, I don't like stouts. One bottle cap. Oh, for the love of Christ, people, just expand your mind.
Yeah.
Expand your palate. And if you don't like stouts, don't drink it.
Don't check it in. Just don't rate it, right?
Yeah, you know, don't hurt these brewers' ratings because you personally don't like a stout.
That's a really good point, Sal, because I think that's just incredibly dumb and amazingly self-centered, right? To just say, I don't like this style, so I'm going to give it one cap, and the rest of y'all can fuck off if you like that style.
Pretty much.
That's really weak.
I'll check it every now and again, and I've learned over the years just to kind of forgo it. I respect everybody's rating and what they you know say, but if you are checking in a beer and you do say this comment, like, who is that speaking to? Because if you say you don't like the beer, like that style of beer, if you don't like the specific style of beer and you write that on there and you rate it low, like, who is that for? And some people will say, well, I'm just taking note for my own record. I'm like, well, that's interesting, because you already know that you don't like it because you wrote it.
Yeah.
So
there's literally nothing constructive that comes from
it's,
that, right?
It, yeah, it's interesting.
What is the point?
Yeah.
You know, and you
that's,
gotta,
a, that's a big thing amongst brewers. I've seen that conversation so many times.
Yeah, it's like that Yelp kind of mentality that I think we get. And you guys know this, where with judging beers and, you know, my background with wine evaluation, lots of times you have to put, okay, there are particular styles of wine, particular styles of beer that I like better than others and things like that. But if I'm being asked to evaluate something professionally, you actually have to put that aside and say, is this, okay, and I love stouts, but, you know, in this case, I have to put, maybe I'm hypothetically not a fan of stouts. I need to be able to say, this is a really well-made stout. It's categorically correct and all that kind of stuff, even though that doesn't play into my taste. This isn't what this is about. And, I mean, I think this is kind of where, I mean, a lot of these points in this article that we're even citing from are kind of made here, where we're talking about in this world where it's great when consumers and enthusiasts have an opportunity to interact. We want people's opinions.
Right.
We want people to be engaged. But there has to be a sensibility in it.
That is
to
true.
A degree.
And you just, this just makes me think of, like, I'm trying to find, like, an equivalent to what this would be like in another world or in a different kind of setting. And say you buy a TV, and you don't watch a whole lot of TV, but you want to have a TV for your kid. And so you buy a nice flat screen TV and you put it on your wall, and then say you buy it from Amazon or wherever it is, and you go and write your review and you give it a one, and your comment is, I just don't like TV, but you bought it.
Right.
Like, that doesn't make sense.
That's not what we're, I mean, and look, and we want people's opinions. So if you're not doing the professional thing like we often do, where you're going to put that, as you said, Matt, put on a different cap and look at it differently to judge it for what it is, you're putting your personal tastes aside. But this idea that then you would just, because, you know, giving an opinion on something and you don't like the category, it's like going out. Yeah, exactly. It's like saying, I don't like convertibles. And so you get in a convertible and you say, this is the worst car ever. Well, you don't like convertibles, you know. So what's the point? What is even the point of rating something?
Right.
I mean, if you just come out and simply say, I'm not a fan of stouts, they have one here, I'm just not a fan of the category, and then you leave it at the, don't give it a one cap rating. I mean, that just don't rate the beer, right?
You know, I think if you want to learn to be a better beer judge, whether that's personally, professionally, or you're thinking about getting certified through the BJCP or what have you, you know, get on the Apple Store, get on Google Store, talking about apps, download the BJCP guidelines, download the Brewers Association guidelines, PDF, but you can still find them, and read about these beers while you're drinking them. You know, you can evaluate the aroma, the appearance, the flavor, the mouthfeel, the overall impressions while you're drinking it, and take a step back from your personal thoughts and your personal bias, and evaluate those beers against what the guidelines are. You know, I've got no problem if somebody rates a beer a one cap beer and they can articulate and say, hey, it's missing this, or it lacks that, or it could have more of this. Cool, I dig it 100%. But, you know, you can go find on YouTube even brewers who read, just Google brewers who read Untappd ratings and watch the hilarity ensue. Okay. You know, literally, good one. I don't like stouts, one cap.
Okay, that's and that's just unacceptable, really. All right, you guys, we're going to close this out. But, Matt, one more time, tell people where they can find you at Old Rail.
Yep, we're in Old Mandeville, 639 Gerard Street. We are to the east of the causeway, about 40 miles from New Orleans.
And website, Facebook, all that stuff?
Yeah, that's oldrailbrewery.com.
I think you just put Facebook, that in Facebook, it'll pop up, right?
Yeah, all that. Yep, it's all on there, hours, everything like that.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Sal, BJCP?
Beer Drug Certification Program, worldwide organization. By all means, if you want to learn how to be a judge or go watch a competition, be judged, participate, you can reach out, find competitions, exams. You can find me on there, Assistant Southern Rep, and more than happy to get you started in the beer judging.
Yeah, because you proctor tests and get people certified in the process.
Correct.
And I will apologize because I referred to you, and Matt, you'll appreciate this. I referred to Sal as a master beer judge as opposed to a grandmaster beer judge.
Of course, you got
to
get that right.
Yeah, well, because I know he'd be pissed and hold it against me until the next time.
Still an unpaid position, still an Sal, unpaid no matter position. How many ranks you go up in the judging
at
world.
The grand, yeah. He's pulling out his wallet to show us his certification card as we speak. But friends, we're going to take a little break here, a musical interlude, and then I'll be back with my parting shot.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening in to the show this week. I do appreciate it. As always, as I mentioned at the top of the show, got a great show for you next week. We are going to continue on with our NOLA Neighborhoods series, the second installment thereof. And we're going to be talking about a particular neighborhood and area in New Orleans Central City, Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. A lot of cool things happening there. It's got a very fascinating history, did play and continues to play a very important cultural and economic role to the New Orleans world here. And I hope you will tune in for that one. Friends, this is our parting shot. And something we touched on in the last segment, a little bit about consumer reviews and things like that. And I think, you know, look, let's frame it this way. Consumer reviews, they can be great. I think one of the best things that they can do is they can engage conversation. Now, when I talk about consumer reviews, you know, typically we're talking about Google rating or Yelp or even people putting their opinions out there in Facebook groups, you know, kind of that whole big world of that sort of stuff out there. Now, they do, of course, have their limitations and problems. So let me start here a little bit. When people who are professional judges, and like in the case of Sal and Matt being professional beer judges, I've done professional level wine evaluation for a very long time, judge cocktail competitions. What we're asked to do is based on criteria. And let me go a little further into that. What I mean is that you have to typically put what you like aside, what I subjectively like aside, and judge for what something is supposed to be. So even if I'm not a huge fan of the style or a huge fan of that particular spirit, that's the cocktail competition we're judging, a particular style of wine region, whatever we're talking about, that's not up for me to actually imbue into the judging process when I'm evaluating something. And the same goes for judging anything else like Matt and Sal do with beers. Criteria is important. There are things like in, say, wine, and the same things will be true for beer. You know, something is so-called varietally correct. Big world of Cabernet Sauvignon out there, but ultimately, does it express itself as a Cabernet Sauvignon should? And that can mean a lot of different things. Varietally correct. Same thing, stylistically correct. Is it an American light style lager? Okay, you have to know what the criteria is that defines an American light style lager, and then is the beer that you're evaluating stylistically correct to that criteria? That's critical to being a judge. You have to be as objective as you possibly can and put the subjective aside. Now, this can require, of course, a lot of understanding and skill. You have to know the breadth of what's out there. You have to understand the landscape. You have to know all of these things, and you have to obviously be familiar with the rules and the criteria under which you're being asked to judge. And sometimes that can be limiting as well, but that's part of your job also. Now, I'm a firm believer in the idea that you have to know the rules before you break them. And I know in things that I'm supposed to evaluate, supposed to judge, it's pretty clear to me when that happens. Pushing boundaries is fantastic, but it's almost always entirely clear to somebody in this role that you understood what you were doing to push the boundaries, meaning it sits on the framework or sits on the bedrock of the classic or the traditional or what it's supposed to be, and then you've pushed it a little further, and kudos to you for doing that. But if you're just sort of throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks and you're calling it something, sometimes that doesn't necessarily work. One of the things that happens a lot of times, too, in consumer reviews, and let me say this, too, that the where we were pulling some of these anecdotes from was from an article that appeared in VinePair a few weeks back. I want to give them credit. It was just a collection of quotes from different beer professionals who were identifying trends and sort of their reaction to them. So I just want to mention that. One of the quotes in there was talking about how, you know, it's great that consumers review beers, but too often people get hung up in archetypes of beers within a particular style or category. So what I mean by that is that they'll say, okay, well, you're looking at Mexican-style lagers, right? And you'll simply say, well, I don't like it, or it doesn't taste like Corona. It's not as good as Corona. I don't like Corona. But it's but, you know, and then kind of using that as the barometer without understanding that there can be a whole host of beers with different expressions and different flavor profiles or whatever the case may be within a larger category. So just latching on to one particular beer, one particular archetype can be very, very dangerous. You become very monolithic, and you're not very likely you're actually missing the breadth of what's out there and what you really should be comparing and contrasting with. You can basically miss the mark entirely on what a category can be about if you're just basing your interpretation of that category on one expression. So that's something else to kind of think about, friends, when you're out there. If you're doing consumer reviews and talking about things, don't just compare it to the one beer in the category you know and say it's not good because it's worse or it's better because it's better. That's a little bit limited in how you're supposed to, I feel, properly evaluate something and really garner a larger world of understanding and maybe taste something new that you didn't know about. We'll get to there in a second. One of the ones that absolutely drives me crazy, and the last one I'll be critical of here, is the idea that somebody will just simply say, I don't like this, therefore I'm giving it 1 star. What I mean is you might go into a brewery and you're using your beer app, and we touched on this one. It's like, I don't like stouts, so therefore I'm giving this 1 star. Well, just because you don't like it doesn't mean that others don't or won't. And frankly, it's not fair to a producer who has done a good job making this beer or that beer, and only to have somebody come in and basically lower the ratings, the aggregate ratings, simply because they don't like the style itself. What do you do in that situation? If you don't like stouts, then just don't rate it. Unless you're prepared to kind of do what we were talking about at the beginning of the segment, putting the subjective aside and evaluating it for what it is. But, you know, that's a tough thing to do if you're not a professional doing this. Certainly what you like matters most, but what you like matters most, mostly, to you. Remember, others may not share the same taste. So, of course, when it comes to consumer reviews, they can be useful, and I do look at them. But I always try and take them for what they are, both specifically and overall. The same thing goes for when I consider professional evaluations. Lots of times, people, I don't care for, like, wine critics, for example, many of them, I don't care for their overall taste, so I don't put too much weight on it. There's a lot of information, friends, out there from consumers, enthusiasts, amateurs, professionals, everything in the middle, everything at either end, and you have to kind of, I think, weigh these things. I think it can be great if you take these multiple sources and put them all in a basket and maybe make, you know, have that information in your back pocket to be aware and a little bit educated and know maybe what you're getting into, but you need to take a balanced approach when you look at all of these things out there. Don't just say one place or one person is the gospel. I think that's really, really important. But really the most important thing, friends, the best thing to do is get out there and try something for yourself. You may be surprised. You may find something totally unexpected that you love, regardless of what someone else has actually said about it. Form your own opinion, friends. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.